Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Toni Morrison grew up in Lorain, Ohio, as Chloe Ardelia Wofford. She got an eyeful of American life and the weight of race and racism. She got an earful of stories that stayed with her. By college, she had a new nickname, Toni. By marriage, a new surname, Morrison. Now, Toni Morrison is one of the biggest names in American literature. And the woman behind the name at 81 is still watching, remembering, writing. This hour on Point, Toni Morrison and her latest novel, Home. You can join the conversation. What does Toni Morrison's work mean to you? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Toni Morrison joins us now from Katona, New York, not so far from her home on the Hudson River, author of The Bluest Eyes, Sula, Song of Solomon, Beloved, and many more. She won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1987, the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1993. This year, President Obama named her one of 13 recipients of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Her new novel, Home, takes us to the 1950s, a troubled black Korean War vet headed home from war, and to the trouble and redemption he finds at home. Toni Morrison, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
It's very, very
good being here.
It's good. It's good to have you back. Listen, I want to talk all about the 1950s and your new book, but can we just hold up for a second on Chloe Ardelia Wofford? I never really got that, and I'm sure a lot of people, others may not have either. And then I read that despite, you know, Toni Morrison is your nameplate, but you still think of yourself as Chloe. Is this true?
Yeah, the people who know me best still call me Chloe, and that's the person that lives outside of the public world. And as a matter of fact, the very first book I wrote, I intended to use Chloe Wofford. But I forgot, and by the time I called them, they said it was already in the Library of Congress or something. So I was annoyed, but then there was nothing.
That was you when it came to writing. How did it happen that you migrated from Chloe Wofford to Toni Morrison? The Toni
part. Well, my saint's name is Saint Anthony.
Uh-huh.
Anthony is my name, my baptismal name, and you know, some girls in the dorm at Howard University who had difficulty, like many people did, in pronouncing my name. Mm. Even in school, teachers would say Klo or Shlo or
whatever.
It wasn't
so popular then as it is
no,
now.
No, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. No one could really pop, right. So I let them call me Toni.
And the Morrison part came with a marriage that is now half a century behind you.
Very much behind me.
So how do you look on this other name then, your most famous name, your Nobel Prize winning name, Toni Morrison? Do you hold that, I don't know, like Sam Clemens held Mark Twain? Or how do you look at it?
I look at Toni Morrison as the one who's talking to you and the one who will be on television and signing books and being as cooperative and welcoming as possible, a public person. But Chloe is the one who will go home on the river and write or not, mm-hmm. or call a close friend. Become deliberately schizophrenic.
What? To free the mind and roll with it.
That's right. Exactly.
Wow. But when you sit to write, it's still the Chloe that goes all the way back to Lorain, Ohio.
Absolutely. Yes, certainly.
And the stories that your parents told you there, I've read that they're kind of, I don't know if ghost stories is the right word, but sort of fables were still inform or have always informed your writing. What was that family tradition, if that's the right word?
It was. We did that for entertainment. And the stories were awful and were ghoulish, ghost stories, chilling. Not only did they tell them repeatedly, but they asked us to tell them also, and we could tweak them a little bit, you know, change the voices perhaps, mm-hmm. or the emphasis. But, you know, all children's stories were scary. The ones in the book, Hansel and Gretel and people who are being eaten by wolves. themselves. Mm. They all turned out to be, I suppose, lessons. But I'd never read, except by the time I was in the second grade, happy fairy tales and children's stories in, you know, Grimm's Yellow Book or something. Mm-hmm. But primarily they were scary.
And here you are at 81 now, how years creep up on us, and writing in Home, and very early in this book you've got a boy and a girl, the sort of Chloe age, the right back to the stage you were in Ohio, and they're watching horses fight, and they're peering through tall grass and a fence and seeing a very scary situation where somebody's being buried. It's kind of right back to your parents' genre.
It's true. They were on a little adventure in a very sleepy, to them boring town, nothing exciting going on, looking for excitement, and they frequent this ranch, stud ranch, mm-hmm. and they watch these horses fighting. And for the main character in the book, Frank Money, it's a sign of three things: brutality and beauty and manhood. And he keeps that picture with him as a kind of reference on everything he's to do later mm-hmm. in life.
And then this child's eye view, they're lying low in the grass, so low, looking under the grass and fence, they can only see ankles and earth. And someone's being buried in that earth. And they see in the color of the skin tone, in the paleness of the bottom of the foot, this is a black person being sent into the earth, dead or near dead.
Yeah, he's thrown into a hole in the ground, a grave already made for a body, and the brother, the older brother, tries to prevent his sister from seeing it. But there's this foot that's sort of quivering outside the grave, and then the man is buried. They only see the legs of the buriers. They don't see their faces. So they're frightened, and they stay there until it's dark before they even try to go home.
Michiko Kakutani in the New York Times reads your book and Home, new one, and says it's a kind of, it's a powerful, it's written in a very direct way, maybe unusual in a way for you. I want to talk about that, which is it's a kind of tiny Rosetta Stone to your complete body of work, that you can find all of Toni Morrison in this slim, really effective new novel. What do you think of that? Do you see a Rosetta Stone here?
No. For me, the differences among the books I've written, some are stories, tales, characters, but for me as a writer, it's a structure. All of the meaning lies in the structure, the way it is told. Here, I did something I thought was quite different for me and mm-hmm. certainly a little bit radical, which is having the character speak directly mm-hmm. to the writer, mm-hmm. not to the reader, mm-hmm. but to the writer, and the process of the back and forth, whether he deceives, lies, tells the truth, etc., is a learning process. Now, I have had many times, or a few times, narrators who were never identified. They were sort of voices that mm-hmm. you couldn't place. That was true in jazz. It was true in love. But here I was, I thought, a little bit more aggressive about that. Whereas instead of doing what you say, the New York Times critic says, which is collecting everything that I've generally spoken about as a Rosetta Stone, for me the writing process is so different. That's what excites me. And here, of course, trying to do something, I don't know, certainly about a decade, a sort of 50s nostalgia, and having that scrim or veil pulled away from it to look at what was really going on in the 50s.
That is very clearly coming across. I almost felt as if you were trying... even with some urgency to, in a way, teach a younger generation or remind them what it was like that late on so they don't think the hard stuff was all the way back in, I don't know, 1860 or 1910, 1950, you name it, and it's just rough as you can imagine.
Yes, it was. It was. It held all the seeds that sprouted later on in the 60s and 70s. They were all there. And I wanted to talk about what, not that sort of golden age of the 50s that we sometimes, at least in the
happy
media
days
discourse.
And Mad Men. Yeah,
yeah, happy days. But this was what it was really like. I knew it because that was when I became, I was a young woman, mm-hmm. 19 and 20, off to college. And I remember that part of my own life as a combination of joy, success, and absolute amazement at the kinds of restrictions, racial and gendered, that were on us all and what we had to do, how we had to live through it. But putting it in the hands of a boy, a young boy, a man, mm-hmm. and remembering what I think many people have forgotten, which is that there was a big time war, which apparently never ended since we still have a zone up there, the militarized zone between...
On the Korean Peninsula.
Down the north and south, yeah.
1950s, with the fear and brutality still very much there in the story of a young black veteran coming home from the Korean War. The new novel is Home. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking today with writer, American great, Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison about her new book, Home. And a now long life in literature and America. Toni Morrison joins us today from Katona, New York. And Toni, I wonder if you'd read a little bit where your character, Frank Money, young man, is come home to the States, to the U.S. From war. He's had trouble right from the get-go with authorities who looks like jail and then a mental ward they throw him in. He does have some PTSD, but he's been treated rough right from the start. He's traveling home, and he's got these episodes where the PTSD just comes over him. Could you read a bit for us?
Yes. It happened the first time when he boarded a bus near Fort Lawton, discharged, papers intact. He was quiet, just sitting next to a brightly dressed woman. Her flowered skirt was a world's worth of color, her blouse a loud red. Frank watched the flowers at the hem of her skirt blackening and her red blouse draining of color until it was white as milk. Then everybody, everything, outside the window, trees, sky, a boy on a scooter, grass, hedges, all color disappeared and the world became a black-and-white movie screen. He didn't yell then because he thought something bad was happening to his eyes. Bad but fixable. He wondered if this was how dogs or cats or wolves saw the world. Or was he becoming colorblind?
Was he becoming colorblind? Toni Morrison reading from her new novel, Home There. This, all that stress from war and really horrors that he had seen there, bringing it back to a country where it is anything but colorblind. As you write it, the story of him getting from the West Coast finally back to his hometown in Georgia, I mean, it is like an obstacle course of the first order, getting through all the suspicion and anger and easy violence that he faces on that trip.
Oh, yes, it was like it was another battlefield for him. Transportation was a major problem for African Americans, where you had to sit if you could get on in a train at all, were the cars limited to mm-hmm. certain kinds of people. Certainly the question of where you could eat. You had to prepare, take huge lunches with you because you were certain never to be allowed to sit down in any routine public place. And, of course, you were subject, as he was, to searches by police who were designed to just look at any black man. And what is redemptive about that journey, even as I remember it as a young woman, were those black porters on the trains who really took care of other black people. Gave us twice as much orange juice and two pillows instead of one. And so it made the segregation irrelevant almost because you had the really good care of those all-black porters back in the days.
Almost irrelevant. Almost, but almost as important.
Almost.
reading this, you know... As a white reader, and I'm thinking now about all the soldiers coming home, and we've been very attuned to what they've come home with, how hard it is after every war. And here's your black vet, and he comes back with that, in his case, that there is a little bit of madness going on that he's wrestling with. And then he has to bring it into a kind of bigger madness of how you deal with the hostility, the brutality. It could drive you crazy all on its own. It makes it almost an impossible human situation, but for the kindness of black folk along the way, who their mercies are so sweet because they're so vital for him to survive.
Oh, it's true. I remember that feeling myself when, for the first time, I went south with a theater group as a college student, and there were infinite numbers of places where we encountered serious segregation. And when we needed rescue to find a place to eat or a place to stay, the faculty who had accompanied us would go and telephone a black church or hear from somebody in a black neighborhood where it was possible to eat. And it was a kind of relief to know that there was help, safety, and care all along the route, in spite of the outside world, which seemed designed and was designed to limit, prohibit, if not just jail you.
Well, it's not as though we're living in a paradise today. But do you think young African Americans understand, you know, how recent and how hard that was? Are you in a way trying to remind, or is that always part of the project?
It hasn't struck me as a kind of teaching, but perhaps as a teacher, I've done that for 30 years. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, part of the reason I write, and of course the subjects I have chosen. But history is always in the process of being rewritten or recast in some way, and certainly a lot of what is true about this country has been erased. You know, they just never talk about certain kinds of things. It's like you never hear anymore publicly about, say, the president's mother or his grandfather or his grandmother who were white. They've been erased from the public discourse. And the same thing is true about certain aspects of our own history. I mean, home itself, it's a really peculiarly American idea. Maybe because most people, certainly most, if not all, white people are immigrants or come from immigrants. Mm. The notion of home is titillating and thrilling and powerful. When I go to Europe, they don't even know what that means. They talk about nations, et cetera, and character. But that sort of romantic, loving notion about home is not as powerful there as it is here.
You write about how that notion of home, then the reality of home, could be so easily denied to African Americans. This is Frank Money looking back on his own youth when his family was thrown out of a town in Texas. Reading, I wonder if you might do for us to describe just how tenuous that grip on home might be. People just showed up and told them, white people, out of here. Could you read a little bit of that from Home, Tony?
Oh, sure. Better than most. He knew that being outside wasn't necessary for legal or illegal disruption. You could be inside, living in your own house for years, and still, men, with or without badges, but always with guns, could force you, your family, your neighbors, to pack up and move, with or without shoes. 20 years ago, as a 4-year-old, he had a pair, though the sole of one flapped with every step. Residents of 15 houses had been ordered to leave their little neighborhood on the edge of town. 24 hours, they were told, or else. Else meaning die. It was early morning when the warnings came, so the balance of the day was confusion, anger, and packing. By nightfall, most were pulling out, on wheels if available, on foot if not. Yet, in spite of the threats from men, both hooded and not, and pleadings from neighbors, one elderly man named Crawford sat on his porch steps and refused to vacate.
And in Toni Morrison's new novel, Home, he's tied to the oldest magnolia tree in the county in his own yard, beaten to death, and his eyes are carved out. Things get rough in a hurry. Toni Morrison reading there from Home. She joins us today from Katona, New York. Toni, we have a lot of callers who would like to talk with you. Let me go, if I may, to Irene in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on with Toni Morrison.
Hello, Tom. I'm calling to say thank you to Toni Morrison. I would have never finished high school were it not for my running into her book in 1970, reading The Bluest Eye. I was a ward of New York State and never liked reading because there were really no books that remotely reflect my reality. And I happened to run across some words of Toni that to this day I pass on to a lot of urban kids. Thanks to Toni, not only did I finish high school, but went on to Wellesley, Columbia, and then Harvard. But these are the words that I pass on.
Mm-hmm.
Said this, and this, like, this is my Bible. Toni wrote this. She had nothing to fall back on. No maleness, no whiteness, not ladyhood, not anything. And out of the profound desolation of her reality, she may well have invented herself. And those words not only shaped my reality for the future, but Toni was a model for me that I could not only invent myself, but here she was, who had done somewhat similar.
Out of profound desolation, she invented herself. Wow.
I love that call. That's wonderful to hear. Wonderful.
That's great, Irene. And the words you lived by, and it sounds like invented yourself by Irene.
I certainly. Well, she gave me the blueprint.
That's pretty high.
Congratulations.
Value. Congratulations. Irene, I really appreciate your sharing that with us. If I may, Toni, let me go to Julie in Paulette, Vermont. Julie, you're on.
Well, I guess this is going to be a fan club day because I'm a 72-year-old grandmother. And when Toni accepted the Nobel Prize, she said something to the effect of language creates you as you create it. Forgive me if I didn't get that exactly right. But because I was a teacher, that was profound and gave me a tool to get children and adults to understand that they, in their language, what they say and what they don't say, everything about them is communicating who they are. And I thank her to this day. I have 12 grandchildren, and now I'm teaching them that universal truth. Never forgot it. It's not anything I had to write down. It was there, present, and all the time. So thank you.
Oh, it's delightful to hear that. Language is generative.
Julie, thank you.
Yeah.
Remind us, Toni, what you meant by that. Language creates us as much as we create language.
Well, it's not dead. It's alive. We're saying things. We're the only ones that do. Not just communicate, but shape language. It distinguishes us as species and certainly individually. What you say and how you say it matters. The degradation of language, it's turning into state language or corrupt language shapes the person who speaks that way and shapes the person who hears it that way. But language is the distinguishing feature, one of the distinguishing features, aside from the urge to make art, that human beings have. And it can die.
Language.
With us, a certain kind. Language can die. Mm.
And with it, that generative power. Toni Morrison is with us today. Her new novel is Home. Toni, in your new book, you've got a style that, you know, I've read a lot of your books, and you've got less of that kind of Faulknerian voodoo going on in there, a little less of that Garcia Marquez magic realism. In your prose itself, it seems more straight ahead. Where does that come from?
It seems to me that certain topics demanded a widening of the imagination to include Africanistic and African-American tropes like ghosts, mm-hmm. Like magic. My family were full of deeply religious people, which is partly magical, mm-hmm. and very scholarly and interested in reading, but they did not question the existence of outside things, of forces, and they did have visions, and it wasn't a question of alarm, it was a question of interest to them. So I was never aware of pulling magical things from other texts. It was part of the life and the existence of my family and other families like mine. But in this book, you're right, I have a couple of figures that could be Frank Money's imagination, mm-hmm. but might not be, which is the man in the zoot suit.
Mm-hmm. Who
either
keeps showing up.
Him up showing up when he was on the train and then again in a friend's house while he slept. But it's true that this was one of those efforts to say more with less. I can write forever and give more details and more thoughts and more conversations and more characters if I want to. But this story of home required a certain restraint and discipline, while at the same time, you know, summoning up very vivid pictures and feelings.
But there steps
but
up
less
your
seen more.
Mm-hmm. And there steps up your zoot suit guy, maybe a figure of imagination. I was reminded of how sort of folks on the outside can use clothing itself and still very much do, whether it's baggy trousers down way below the hip or a zoot suit pulled up way high with those balloon trousers. There's a statement saying, I'm not a prisoner of convention here and will not be.
That's true. It's very aggressive. Costumes, very aggressive. With, as you say, those awful jeans too low on the behind, as well as the zoot suits who were up above the waist, and wide brim hats, and you know the police were just encouraged to wrap up those people, whether they were Latinos on the West Coast or African Americans on the East Coast. But costume changing, you're right.
People
aggressive,
saying,
right, individualistic.
I'm not bowing to conventions that are not working for me, and I'm wearing that posture right on my body. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with writer, American great Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison about her new book, Home, and a now long life in literature and America. Toni, let me go right to our listeners, if I may. Yenge is calling from New York, Potsdam, New York. Yenge, you're on the air with Toni Morrison.
Hi, Tom. My name's Yenge Potsdam. I'm 15, and I'm an African-American myself, mm-hmm. and I've been kind of interested in history recently, and it kind of interests me how people really don't take into account what happened, like, I guess you could say back in the day, you know, like even you can kind of see remnants of just about everything that happened in the past in our everyday lives, and it kind of amuses me that people don't really take that into account more. Like, especially with race, we're kind of taught that that's a thing of the past, that, you know, we're kind of behind it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But we really, nobody really wants to pay attention to how, like, things like what happens in the book affect our everyday lives.
Do you feel like you're beyond race? Your neck of the woods is beyond race in your daily life, Youngie?
I personally don't think so. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever get beyond race.
Youngie, I appreciate your call.
Much better than what it was.
Yeah, we got it, Youngie, and I appreciate that. Tony, what's the right balance of remembering and moving on?
I don't find a difference. That is to say, the past is infinite.
Mm-hmm.
The future may be, but I'm not sure about mm-hmm. that. But you cannot erase, let me put it this way. If you think about yourself, your own life, you don't erase your childhood, forget about it because now you're 16, or forget about when you were 16 because now you're 36. All of this is part of you.
Mm.
All of this is part of your emotional and intellectual DNA. So why would you erase the history of your country or of your family? It's part of who we are. In 1967, you couldn't be, blacks and whites could not marry each other in Virginia. Mm-hmm. That recent. And Emmett Till was killed in 1954. And there were instances of violence very similar to the ones we see now of interracial or violence against black people.
You're talking Trayvon Martin or...
Yes,
mm-hmm.
of course. And many others that don't have the... that didn't get the attention, didn't have the parades, didn't have the voices. It happens all the time. I remember doing once a play called Dreaming Emmett about a black teenager. I won't just bore you with the plot, although it was exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But I collected photographs of all the young black men who had been shot in the back in New York that year. There were 14. And I had their pictures, their junior high school pictures, their high school pictures, little ties, white shirts, jackets, hats. And we put them all together. 14
mm-hmm.
in 1 year.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot.
Oh, yeah.
You said, you're 81 now, and you said, you know, if I read correctly, Tony, that as you grow older, you feel more freedom to feel exactly what you want to feel, to have exactly whatever attitude comes to you, just to be there with that in the moment, not put any varnish on it.
Yeah, that means I'm a little evil.
Well, okay.
Well, no, there's no reason now to do anything but the thing you feel. There's nothing to cover up, and there's nothing to, force on other people. I do feel enormously liberated after all these years, 81 of them.
Mm.
The only difficulty is sometimes my body doesn't agree.
Well,
but my mind is out there. And the pleasure of being in the natural world increases every year. I'm just stunned by how absolutely beautiful the world is.
How do you hold
that? I sort of took it for granted before.
Yeah. How do you hold that up against the hardship? And there is plenty of hardship. You've known in your own family, lost a son in the last couple of years, and we're sorry for that. How do you hold it up against the hard things that so many people know?
And they belong together. I think the loss of my son intensified after I, mourned forever and made me think about what he would approve of. And what he would approve of is a mother who was not wallowing in grief and paralyzed by grief. What he would want would be an active, intelligent, honest woman who enjoyed life. So the two things go together in a way.
Son lost to cancer, but still, you're probably right about what he would want. Kelly in Roxbury, Massachusetts. Kelly, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for being so on point with this show today.
You're very welcome.
Miss Morrison, I wanted you wanted first to wish you the best on this Mother's Day weekend.
Oh, yes.
and understanding the loss of your son.
Thank you.
And also had a question about a quote. I don't know if the quote was correct, but it had you saying that the 21st century was not a nice place to be. and if you did, in fact, say that, because I know oftentimes public figures are quoted as to something they didn't say, but if you did, in fact, say that, could you elaborate a bit on what you meant?
Well, I did say that. I said the 21st century was not pleasant, and all I see about me, excuse me, is slaughter, murder, guns, rape, children being abused. I mean, where's the good stuff? The 21st century is not pleasant. With all we know, all we've gone through, it's still this bloody century.
Worse than others?
I don't know, but it's bloody enough. And what I was telling that journalist was that in spite of that horror of what's going on, I wrote, and that made the world all right for me. Everything works. Everything was useful. Whether I used it or discarded it, I was attentive and sensitive to everything going on in the 21st century because of the root I had access to, which was in the novels.
The latest is Home. Kelly, thank you for your call. One more, Mark in Wethersfield, Connecticut. Mark, you're on with Toni Morrison.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And Mrs. Morrison, I wanted to ask you, you've been around for a few years, and you've been through so much. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on President Obama's statement this week of him thinking that it was fine for same-sex couples to marry, and that maybe the struggles that gay people have gone through, black people, women, that there are contrasts. Or maybe not with that. I just wanted to know your comments on that.
Thank
and I
you,
just
Mark.
Love hearing you talk, Miss Morrison.
Thank you. I was surprised about the announcement, but extremely happy that it was made. I never thought ever that Barack Obama thought that marriage between men and men, women and women was horrifying. He just had no, way to articulate it. And perhaps it was politically unwise. I don't know. But whatever it was courageous. It was a delight. And it somehow, I don't know, I breathed a sigh of relief. I know that in, 30, 40 states, they got laws or they're passing laws to ban exactly what he said, what should be part of, the rights of human beings. But nevertheless, it's up there now. And I'm delighted with his public statement about how he personally felt.
What do you think when people equate the push for gay marriage with the civil rights movement? Do you see a parallel?
In some ways, but for me, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because the people who are saying no to gay marriage are saying that always the marriage has always been between a man and a woman, and that's just not true. I mean, marriage originally is a man with 50 wives, 60 wives, King Solomon had what, 700? So that was about property. That's what marriage was always about. The idea of love is very modern, very recent. That's what we call the Romantic Age. Mm. Before that, it was about the acquisition of land, cattle, money, gold, and you married off your daughters. Or men married many people. You know, ask Mitt Romney's grandfather, who had 5 wives. So that there, and the fact that it was normal is that they had to have laws preventing polygamy. They wouldn't have needed those laws preventing polygamy if marriage had not included multiple wives. So now they're saying this is the way it has always been. Not true. Marriage has evolved.
Though you're still describing male-female, even though it's not really appealing the way you put it there with 50 or 700.
I'm sorry about that. But I understand there are places where women, in Tibet, there were women who had many husbands. So maybe there's a little slice of, you know, matriarchy in the marriage saga. But anyway, you know, that's my view.
Tony
All
Moore,
change is resistant.
I wanted to ask you on that again on that subject. There has lots of reports of particular resistance to the acceptance of same-sex marriage in the African-American community. Why?
I think I don't really know why because, I mean, really, I know there is some resistance among African-American preachers and congregations, and I sort of regard them the way I do Catholic congregations. You know, there are many gay people in the African-American community and in the African-American churches. If you don't believe it, just read Jimmy Baldwin, who was a child preacher. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true among Catholics. I mean, I speak as a Catholic. Their refusal to countenance this, and also the difficulty they had with countenancing sexual abuse of their own young boys in the cathedrals and in the schools. So there's, you know, it doesn't work. There's something wrong. There's somebody hanging on to something that is sliding from their hands, which is authority. And that's the scary thing. If you don't have authority over, you know, whatever you believe is the right thing, you cannot adjust yourself to change. But I know that there are probably the same number of homosexuals, men, among African-Americans who are church-going people as in other parts of the community.
Just men?
Other parts of the states. Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm remembering now that in my hometown of Lorain, Ohio, there was a couple of women, black women, who lived together and were lesbians and wore men's shoes and overalls, and they never straightened their hair. But they worked in the steel mill. They were welders and pipe fitters, and they went to work every day. And the black men and women in my town respected those women. There was never any giggling or any bullying. Nobody was gossiping about them. And I think, looking back, I think it was because they kept to themselves. They didn't bother anybody. They were very obviously lesbian. But they worked in a man's world, doing a man's work extremely well.
Lucky and good for them. One more call, if I may. Maureen in Boston. I'm sorry our time is short, Maureen, but you're on the air with Toni Morrison.
Okay, I'm glad I pulled over my car to call thinking I'd be the first one in, but I'm so glad. Toni, I'd like to end with sort of a tribute on this eve of Mother's Day. Your work has meant a great deal to me. I want to tell you a story My daughter, when she read Beloved, it was a book that was Beloved. She underlined, she turned the pages down, she copied things out of it. And it was the reason I had what I would say my first adult intellectual conversation with her. It was wonderful. And I took that book with me when you were speaking at Harvard when Drew Faust was inaugurated. And I just wanted to share something with you. I tried to run off. I had it in my pocketbook. I wanted to get you to sign it for my daughter. And, of course, they whisked you off. But in front of me in Memorial Church there were about five young African-American women, clearly undergraduates. They all were holding very well-worn copies of your book. And as you spoke, they all wept. And it made me weep because of what your words have meant for women, women of color, and just women in general. And I just wanted, I didn't get to tell you that little story. I wanted to tell you that. And I'm so glad that I've had this opportunity. Tony, we've met.
Maureen, you've got it, the opportunity right here, and I'm afraid that's all the time we've got. But Toni Morrison,
there you go.
There's a Mother's
Day
gift to you. Right from Maureen. Home.
Lovely.
Is the new novel by Toni Morrison. Toni, thank you very much for this, and thanks for being with us today. Great to have you.
It was a great pleasure for me.
There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.